Well, good morning. This is the beginning of a journey for me. And I am hopeful and a little bit excited. My journey concerns my hope to be able to make a change in the policies that create the mass incarceration of poor blacks. And this morning, we'll talk about what it is, how it came about, why it is, and what one might do about it. It clearly shows a failure of our interdependence, which is one of our principles. And I would ask you the question, based on what you know today, do we have a profound misunderstanding of how racial oppression occurs today? It is different. You've been given a handout, which you can peruse, take home. Hope it'll be useful to you. In my 45 years plus of practicing law in this town, I did not realize that this was taking place, but that's no excuse. But what I was able to do, just because I'm a white middle-class male with an education, I was able to achieve my goals as a lawyer, enjoy it, have a successful practice. So now it's time for me to significantly give back. And of course, this concern that I have over mass incarceration of blacks in Greenville County and elsewhere rests on a newly learned awareness that we may have in this country the worst penal system in history of man when you look to the poor black man. And that's a strong statement, hard to believe statement. We fought the Civil War. We had the period of time when we thought we were establishing rights for blacks. We got over the Jim Crow years. How did we allow all of that to creep back in? When I was a 17-year-old senior in high school, I was a bit of a juvenile delinquent, and my mother and daddy, though, took me to First Baptist Church. It was a moderate church on a regular basis, and it came time for the senior class to put on the senior service, which they do in a lot of churches, and no one would do the sermon, and I thought, well, this is my opportunity. I'll get even. I'll do my thing, you know. So I get up there, and I can't believe I did this, and give this hellfire damnation speech as strongly as I could, not believing a word of it. So I have given you a handout in part to support that there is substance to what I'm saying today. And there were no recriminations. Nobody got on to me, you know. I wasn't put in jail, you know. I was given a second chance. In fact, if I look at my life, because you got to look at yourself when you compare yourself to these people that are, and how they're being treated, I see myself as someone who had every advantage, second chances, just hundreds of them, just all the time. And people mentoring me or giving me assistance. What if my life had been no second chance, no one coming to my aid, no one looking over my silly juvenile antics, and a cop standing on the corner of my neighborhood, he wants to frisk me every time I walk by and check and see what drugs I got, see if I've got a little gym clips worth of a crack. I would have gone to jail. No question about it. I wouldn't be here today. Let's look at, I'll give you four examples to try to dramatize what's happening and what I see. In 1986, the U.S. Congress imposed minimum sentences for both crack cocaine and powder cocaine. Now, first, all the cocaine coming into the country comes in powdered form. They take the powdered cocaine for the black community predominantly, and they dilute it with water and bicarbonate soda, and they call it crack. And one smoked, and the direct powdered cocaine is the preference of the whites, and they snort it typically. And crack over in the 80s and 90s and today is still a very, very popular drug. Well, the Congress decided that you know, this is just terrible. We've got to have a minimum sentence for using. I'm not talking about the dealers. I'm talking about the users. 5 years. Well, they decided that if it was crack cocaine, 5 grams would get you 5 year minimum sentence. Well, that's 5 gym clips worth. But for the white powder that the white people are using, it takes 500 grams for a 5 year minimum sentence. Do you see anything discriminatory about it? I don't know. All right, number two. Our local TV channel, WSPA, did this year. Gordon Deal does a study. He has the years 2012 through 2014, the booking records in Greenville County examined. And he's looking at felony drug arrest. 68% of the felony drug arrest were blacks. The rest were made in black neighborhoods. Now let's look at the population demographics of Greenville County. It's 77% white and 19% black. You see something maybe wrong with it? And that's also admitted by the sheriff that, yeah, the white drug use, number one, white sell to white. Young kids in white communities in this country typically use more drugs than in black communities. And the general activity, criminal activity by black and white has never been shown to be significantly different. So this is just a pure act of someone deciding that it's race. And we want to control these young black men, so we put them in jail. That's my interpretation. A third one. Two groups, national groups, came into South Carolina in 2016 and did a study of 27 summary courts. Some people call them magistrate's courts, but it's our lowest level of court. And they chose 27 of them. And they issued a report. Report appeared a few months ago on the front page of the Greenville News talking about how terrible our summary court system is. The things that they found was that the Fourth Amendment and the Sixth Amendment are just generally ignored. And those are our two pillars of our freedom of in this country. I mean, that's where we derive our freedom from. And they do it in lots of little ways, in big ways. And you don't have indigent defense. South Carolina has a public defender system. It's underfunded. If you compare the number of solicitors to the number of public defenders in a particular area, it's probably 10-1. It's something ridiculous. They're not able to render the service because they got 100 cases or whatever. But they're not even present at the summary court. You've got the police officer there as a solicitor, and you've got a magistrate who may or may not have a law degree, but he's got tremendous leeway as to what he does. He can grant a person, let them loose on their own self-recognizance, or he can impose a bond. He can impose fines and penalties for all kinds of little wrong actions. And if you can't pay the fine, he can put you in jail. If someone wants to discriminate, and if you come in there as a poor black man, the odds are that's exactly what's going to happen. Now, number four, we have a policy that was adopted from some a federal concept of a number of years ago, back when the war on crimes Initially, Richard Nixon declared a war on crimes, but he didn't fund it. So it's after that, really, after his presidency, that the funding for the war on crimes gets going good. But as part of that, they enact a forfeiture law, and the concept when it was being sold was that, let's say that you catch this drug lord, and he's going to have all these fancy lawyers, he's going to keep it tied up for a long time. But one way you could really hurt him is if you could seize all his property while it's all being sorted out. Well, as a practical matter, in Greenville County and many places across the country, what it is today, because the law that we then passed in South Carolina was much looser. It doesn't require a policeman to make any determination of a crime being committed. He doesn't have to show probable cause. He just takes your property, period. They could come out and get every car in the parking lot, and you, citizens, would have to sue to get it back. And the burden would be on you. And you wouldn't get your law fees back either. You'd just be, lose money getting your car back. But, of course, that didn't happen to middle-class white people. Because, let's just assume for a second that were to happen, that they go into Chanticleer, they collect all the cars, and they haul them off to the lot. What do you think would happen? Well, it hadn't happened. It's not going to happen. But what they do is they go to these certain black neighborhoods. And if they're arresting the black person, they'll take whatever he's got. Doesn't matter whether or not he's guilty, but and even if they're not arresting him, if he doesn't cooperate with whatever it is they want at the moment, they'll take something from him. It's unconscionable to me that can happen in the United States of America, and happens every day, and it's how we fund our police departments. This property is 98% of this, whatever it is. It's kept by the police department. So they have a financial incentive to go out and do what they're doing. And they do it. And then you've got the Drug Enforcement Agency. It's made things wonderful since it's been around, and it's spent $1 trillion here or there. And they like to fund local police departments that are making drug arrests, because after all, they're the war on drugs. And so they do. And so it doesn't matter whether or not there's a conviction. It doesn't matter whether or not it's 2 grams of crack, or whether it's some guy who actually brought a load in from Mexico. It doesn't matter. They still get the rewards. So we have policing for profit. The sermon that I alluded to earlier that I gave as a juvenile delinquent has a relationship to what I'm talking about, because in 2008, as a candidate, Mr. Barack Obama appears at the Apostolic Church of God in Chicago on Father's Day. And he makes a hellfire damnation speech, except his speech is to black fathers. He's very critical, gets tremendous publicity, because Barack Obama says, you're not doing your duty, fellas. You're not, you've fallen down, you're absent, you're just no good, in effect, Well, where does he think they are? Where are these, you got a million single women out there with black children and no dads. Where are these men? Well, if he'd done a little homework, he'd found out they were part of mass incarceration, and they're all in jail for having possession of a small amount of crack cocaine. Not violent crimes I'm not talking about. I'm talking about possession crimes. And that got a lot of play. At the time, it got a lot of play, and nobody—not the black magazines, not the black leaders, not the NAACP—nobody said, "Well, let's look at how this happened." They just assumed the blacks are no good. They're their own people, and that's troubling. And maybe it comes from slavery, I don't know. But that has continued. It's continued up until a long time, up until at least maybe 2010 when the book was written, The New Jim Crow. May have been something about it before then, but not a lot. And I recommend to you that you read the book, The New Jim Crow, because of everything I've looked at, and I've spent a year trying to get familiar with this subject, it takes everybody to task for their failure. This didn't happen because somebody passed a bad law. This happens because everybody's asleep at the switch. No one's out there saying, you know, I'm a racist and I'm going to put the black man in jail. That's not how this happens. It happens subtly. It happens under, with a little here and a little there. But before you know it, it's accomplished. There's another, and of course the white community, since they're not, nobody's coming to their neighborhood to declare civil forfeitures. Nobody's going into their neighborhood to see who's using heroin. They're just not looking for them. And there are reasons for that too. If you can arrest a person and get the thing done and have a check mark up there that so-and-so got, you know, has been arrested for drug use, so you qualify for whatever money y'all applying for, they're applying for. You certainly don't want to go to Chanticleer where you're going to have five lawyers breathing down your neck and a long, drawn-out proceeding. I think that's apparent. But let's talk about for a moment about the cycle that this creates and what actually happens. First, when you get arrested, you're not going to be released on your own recognizance, most likely. And so you're going to sit in jail. As you're arrested, your property is going to be taken away from you. You're going to lose your job. And then the solicitor comes in there and says, I got a deal for you. He says, now you got a few grams of crack here. That's a mandatory 5-year sentence. It can also carry a fine of, I don't know, $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, whatever it is. All these things now carry fines. There's nothing in the criminal justice system that doesn't have a fine, a penalty, a tax, or something where you got to pay money, no matter how poor you are. If you happen to get indigent defense representation, they file a lien. If you're indigent, you would think you wouldn't get a lien because you ain't got anything, but they do that anyway. So you're rendered homeless and without anything. And you're eventually, but you make a deal with the solicitor because he's got a range of things that he can get imposed on you, or at least ask for, that scares you to death. So he slices it, you know, down a little bit, and you take the deal in 99% of the cases because, you know, that's just what happens. Because it's the power of the solicitor is just too big, too strong. So you're let go. Okay, so you step out of the jailhouse. You've got so many days to report to your parole officer and give him some money. You owe money to all these people that, you know, that these fines and things you've run up. And you can't get work because you've got a felony record. You can't get food stamps because you've got a felony record. You can't get any services provided by any government agency under any circumstances because you've got a felony record. So you sit there and you wonder, now, what's the guy to do? Well, guess. Before that first parole meeting, he's stolen something somewhere, or he's done something to meet the requirement and hopefully stay out of jail a little while. But he goes back to jail. Period. It's not if, it's maybe when, 2 months, 6 months, but he goes back to jail. And it keeps getting worse. The sentences get longer, you know, because of all these wonderful laws we pass. But eventually, in some places now, he can still get life just because he did the same thing 3 times. But in any event, it's bad. And there's nobody to help. You know, they're starting a lot of diversion programs. It's good, you know. But everything has a fee attached to it. If you ain't got any money, you can't pay the fee, you can't get in the program. And of course it helps if you got a nice up-to-do lawyer, you know, who's going to make sure you get in the front of the line and pay everything right and get the benefit of the diversion program. But unfortunately, we don't have diversion programs for people who can't pay the fees are to get into it. So that's kind of how I describe the problem. Now let's look at why. Well, my conclusion is that several factors come together. Politicians lying about the need to be tough on crime. I think that went on for 25 years. His statistics don't support the lies they told to get you to pass the law, accept the laws. Harsher sentences and fines for drug use. Drug use, mind you. Policies like Bill Clinton passed one saying three strikes and you're out. Get arrested three times for something, you know, you go to jail for life. Absurd. Aggressive policing for profit, where they stay in these black neighborhoods constantly harassing, constantly taking things. They make more arrests in the drug area than in other crimes because the DEA is back there backing it with money. Then you have the forfeiture problems. So police have taken control of these black communities. They're trapped. And it just has the effect of enslaving the blacks. Now, where are the black churches? It is shameful in a black church to be arrested and be accused of a crime. They will not support you. And this is, I'm not saying they're wrong, but it's just how it is today. They will not support you if you're that black man I've been talking about up here. And that needs to change. That's just one of all these things that needs to change. But the white man needs to stand up and say, you know, this isn't happening to me, but it's wrong. I'm not going to live in a country where we have the worst criminal justice anywhere in the world. All right, what might we do? I did this little handout, and it also has a reference down on the bottom of the back page. I created a link to my Facebook page. You don't have to go to my Facebook page. You just go to the link. And some things are posted there, and some things will be posted there, giving you some resources. I listed references, some of the references that I found to be helpful. But let me point out just three of the facts that I've listed here that are so disturbing to me. The United States has the most inmates in prisons in the world. In 2013, the United States had 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's inmates. And this is mostly drug use arrest. All right, then one. 1,706,000 children in America with at least one parent in state or federal jail. That bothers me. That's bad. And then one, approximately 500,000 people are in prison or jail compared to 41,000 in 1980. Now, are we that bad now? I mean, did something happen I missed to cause this need to incarcerate that many people in that period of time? I don't believe so. I have a section on what you might do or think about. First, I'd like you to look into this. You know, maybe you'll get excited. Maybe it's something in here you want to take a part in. If either you go to the link on my Facebook page or you go to these addresses here, you'll find where the government has made it real easy for you to email them and find the committees. And all the information about the individuals, you go in there, you sign your name in, and you can get everything you need to either send an email or get everything you need to send a letter. And there are plenty of things here that you could write a letter about. Last thing is what else do I plan to do? I love projects, but I find this a most not just challenging, but It seems a whole lot bigger than I am by so many measures. But I plan to try to find a way to address the black churches, to try to address my fellow lawyers throughout the state, to try to address judges, to try to go in and stir up trouble in summary court in some way, to try to get the summary judges to realize how badly they're acting. But on a federal level, you know, I'd like to see the war on drugs ceased. I'd like to see this fellowship adopt a resolution, or at least to go through the process of discussing whether or not it will adopt a resolution to make all drugs legal and end this mess. Thank you.